KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in Sunnyvale, South Bay.
I live in Oakland, California.
Concord.
Parkside.
San Mateo.
Coming up, we'll analyze the Trump administration's statements and policies on immigration.
If the idea is to get higher skilled immigrants in the United States, it's not clear that being from Norway is a skill.
Then African entrepreneurs meet Silicon Valley investors in Mountain View this weekend to answer this question.
What is it that Africa has to offer to the world that Africa can solve internally, but also with the help of external investment?
And we'll hear from an Iranian-American composer on overcoming trauma through making art.
Sometimes you realize that you have to take advantage of that moment and find some sort of beauty in that and meaning in that, otherwise you wouldn't be able to continue.
That's today on Cross Currents. An anonymous tip about imminent immigration raids in California last week led to a remarkable amount of political backlash throughout the state. And earlier today, the U.S. Justice Department threatened to subpoena so-called sanctuary cities, including San Francisco and Berkeley, if they don't release documents detailing how local law enforcement communicates with federal agencies. Elected officials have made it clear they do not agree with federal immigration policy, from the local level right up to Governor Jerry Brown. Here's Governor Brown speaking about immigration and customs enforcement raids earlier this month.
I do think just breaking up families like that is callous. It's very insensitive, and I can't believe that it will really be carried through.
To learn more about how state and local rights can affect federal action, we contacted Deep Gulasekram. He's a professor at Santa Clara University, specializing in immigration and constitutional law. KALW's Ben Trefney asked him what he thinks of a year's worth of Trump administration's policies and statements about undocumented immigration.
Right. I mean, I think most of them are intended as scare tactics. I think the underlying problem with the Trump administration's tactics is that they have very little relationship to the goal of public safety or community safety. That is, these raids are often high show. They are highly publicized actions. But if we're thinking about long-term systemic effects that are useful immigration policy, that are actually improving public health and community safety outcomes, they actually do very little to advance those sorts of goals.
Then does it seem to follow something that maybe more, I mean, honestly, I want to say xenophobic perspectives that the president may hold and has come across as basically saying in his tweets and sometimes in public appearances, because he's just putting forth scare tactics rather than something that's more substantive, perhaps?
Yeah, I don't think there's any doubt that a lot of this, underlying a lot of this, is a nativism and a xenophobia, a racism, frankly, perhaps influenced by advisors like Stephen Miller and those people around him. But in any case, I don't think there's any doubt that that underlies a significant portion of immigration policy by this administration. And you can think of that in total, right? If you think about the immigration bans, the Muslim bans, the way in which President Trump has referenced countries from which migration is happening, asking for more migration from countries like Norway. If the idea is to get higher skilled immigrants in the United States, it's not clear that being, to me at least, that being from Norway is a skill. Being from Norway does have the connotation of being white, European, etc., and that being deemed a desirable immigrant by this administration. So I don't think there's any doubt that that is part and parcel of the goal of this administration.
So clearly California has established policies that run counter to federal. What power does the state or local governments have when facing federal policies that, you know, fundamentally they disagree with or they don't want to cooperate with?
Yeah, so this is a question not just applicable to immigration law, but in general to the relationship between the federal government and state governments. Fundamentally, the federal government, and this has been interpreted by the Supreme Court in a series of cases, the federal government cannot conscript and force state governments, state officials to do the federal government's bidding. The federal government is welcome to enforce its own laws through its own investigative and prosecutorial force. That's what the FBI does. That's what DEA agents do. That's what ICE agents do in the immigration context. What they cannot do is force states and localities to participate in that federal enforcement. So many of the state laws that you see are policies by which the state is enforcing their right, their ability underneath the Constitution to maintain control over their own law enforcement resources, their own economic resources, etc. And that is all perfectly constitutional.
That's Deep Gulasekaram. He is a professor specializing in immigration and constitutional law at Santa Clara University. But if the federal government decides to press the issue, like this threat of raids suggests, then what kind of defense or action does a state, you know, have at its disposal to use? I mean, it brings to my mind ideas about conflicts potentially between state or local officials and federal officials, because the alternative, it would seem, would just be to stand by and watch.
Yeah, and I think this is the Trump administration is certainly relating these two things. That is to say, because California has taken fairly protective policies, or if you want to think about just policies of non-cooperation, non-participation in federal immigration forces, that the Trump administration is claiming that because of those policies, they need to ramp up federal enforcement. As a constitutional matter, at least as per the cases as they've been interpreted, there really is nothing in the sense of the state can't stop the federal government if it wants from using ICE agents, federal agents, to go about enforcing federal immigration law. The state doesn't have to help. And in fact, the state of California said it is not going to help. And that itself is actually a fairly large practical deterrent to federal enforcement. And the reason that is a large practical deterrent is two reasons. One, the federal government's resources, although they are massive, are certainly limited in the sense that they can't maintain a huge ICE force in California for the purpose of investigation under current funding levels. Second, it is much more likely that local law enforcement and local agencies and state agencies are likely to have information about people, are likely to encounter people, are likely to be the people who've been working in these communities that have non-citizens and perhaps have information and knowledge about whereabouts, etc. And therefore, that is a very valuable resource for the federal government. And that's why you see such an effort by the Trump administration and the Attorney General to attempt to cajole, conscript, influence the ability of localities to participate, because that actually turns out to be one of the significant practical ways in which the federal government does its enforcement. So to your question, California can't stop massive ICE raids through policy, but what it can do is practically make it much more difficult for the federal government to engage in that sort of enforcement.
So do you have any sense for how this may play out going forward?
You know, I think that a key factor is going to be funding in Congress. So sure, at this current moment, even with current funding and current levels of agents, they can engage in hyper-random enforcement that has no priorities for the purpose of scaring people and tearing apart families and making perhaps trying to force people to leave. But if you're really talking about ramping up the number of people that you can investigate and round up, the number of people that you can put into enforcement actions, even in states like California that are not going to help you do so, that's going to require upping the number of agents by the thousands. That's going to require congressional budgetary allocations in the billions and billions of dollars. Already, DHS is the largest federal law enforcement agency that exists. It's bigger than the FBI, the DEA, everything else. So you're talking about a massive increase in personnel. If you get that, then I think there would be greater possibilities of systemic and sustained enforcement by ICE in California and other states that are resisting. If you're not going to get those large budgetary increases, I think what the federal government is going to attempt to do is the same sort of scare and publicity tactic that they are attempting now, which is to engage in high-profile raids which might look good for the moment, which will make the nightly news, which will make it look like the federal government is engaged in this massive enforcement effort. But the fact is that cannot be sustained in some long-term basis without massive increases in funding. And so in the meantime, I do expect the federal government to continue this hyper-random enforcement that is likely not going to produce significant gains in public safety, but might have the ability to scare people.
That was Deep Gulasekram. He's a professor at Santa Clara University, specializing in immigration and constitutional law. He spoke with KALW's Ben Trefney. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. In line with what we just heard about, what many see as a climate of anti-immigration, President Trump has also recently had some things to say about not just immigrants, but about whole countries. When he was recently with elected officials talking about Haiti, El Salvador, and African nations, he referred to them in a vulgar term we've all probably heard by now. Well, this weekend, African entrepreneurs and innovators are converging in Mountain View to talk business. They're here for the African Diaspora Investment Symposium, where they partner with Silicon Valley companies to invest in projects that impact Africa. It's organized by the African Diaspora Network. Founder Almaz Negash says, despite this anti-immigrant, anti-Africa political climate, Africans are cutting deals, building businesses, and growing economies.
For many years, especially in Silicon Valley, Africa has not been very well known. What we wanted to do is, could we bring the Africans and friends of Africa together? One, to co-create possibilities, to make relationship, to form partnership, but also to tell the story of Africa through Africans. In Silicon Valley, very few people really know about Africa. Although I have to say, if you go a little bit deeper, you will find people who have gone there, but mostly as a mission work, you know, just to do some aid work, not necessarily to invest in Africa, but they haven't really seen Africa through the African diaspora lens. And so our job is, at least my job as an Eritrean American, is how can I actually bring Africans together to co-create and co-imagine possibilities, not only for Africa, but also this community in which we live. We, the diaspora, are major contributors of the U.S. economy, especially the African diaspora. Very few people know this, but we are highly educated at the same level as Asians, if not more, in proportion to the number of Africans from the diaspora. Those of us who came to the United States probably after the 50s and the 60s as foreign students, as immigrants, legal immigrants to come and study in the United States, which is what I have done. I came to the U.S. as a foreign student many, many years ago now, 30 years ago. So it has been a long time. So we do find ourselves this to be our home. This is our home. We contribute. My kids are born here, and I'm educated here. My husband works here. So we actually do find this to be our home, and we contribute just as much, maybe more. But at the same time, Africa is our home continent, and we feel connected to that motherland, and we are focusing on harnessing what's within. What is within Africa? What is it that Africa has to offer to the world that Africa can also solve internally, but also with the help of external investment? And so what we're trying to do is connect the need with the solution. In the Valley, you've got very entrepreneurial community that is trying to find other ways of investing. Well, what is needed right now in Africa? Energy is critical. So solar energy and solar energy investment is a big deal. The same thing with agribusiness. That is a huge need in Africa because it is actually almost 75 to 80% of the population depends on agriculture. well, then it behooves one to think about what kind of investment we do. And I do hope people come to the symposium so they can hear what is happening on the agriculture, in technology, education, and especially small farmers, sustainable development. We're talking about a population that is going to be 2.5 billion in 2030 or 2050, I should say 2050. So what does that mean to the world? And also, it's a very young community, young society. So that means employment, education, these are critical, and it's a huge investment for any country or any individual trying to do business in Africa.
So about doing business in Africa, let me ask you, because many people might be thinking, well, you know, it's risky. Is there really money to be made, or is this going to end up being a charity project?
No, I think that's a very fair question. In fact, one of the questions I always ask, and we should always ask as Africans and friends of Africa, is, are these governments of Africa really preparing the continent for business? That is a critical question, because as an investor, if I was going to invest in something, it's a very basic question. Can my return on investment come back to me? To do that, you have to have a legal system. You have to have a security, and security means peace. So there are countries right now working very, very hard, and I would give an example. It's not a perfect system, but you've got Ghana, you've got Nigeria, even Ethiopia, and in her own way, in that continent, the country is doing the best they can with all the unrest in some areas. But I think the government is doing the best they can to bring investment.
How do you keep going? Because this is not easy to do, especially right now in light of the current political climate, with all the anti-immigration talk happening at the highest levels of government. I'm from East Africa. You're from East Africa. Our president just called our countries a certain word that I won't say on the air, but was meant to, you know, demoralize. This is a new climate.
Many people are having a hard time actually getting visa. So, for example, I get people who want to come to the symposium, but they need a visa, and the visas are being rejected. That is a huge problem, not only because they are trying to come to the symposium and cannot attend, but actually the fact that they cannot come because of the place where they live or where they are residing. That in itself, in my opinion, is discrimination. When you have the opportunity to be respected, just like any other country, if Norwegians are good, so are Africans. I don't see any difference. There is no need for that kind of discrimination, but it is happening. People, whether people come to the symposium or not, I think I'm more concerned about the economic well-being of these countries, the fact that they get labeled as terrorist countries or this and that, when actually data and statistics shows that they are not. Here is one thing I know. As an African with a thick skin, this only puts my head up. It never puts me down. In fact, I really believe that we are more encouraged and more empowered to bring a much larger community together, not of only Africans, but Africans and friends of Africa, because I do believe that when we start to know each other, the respect is much higher. It's only when people who don't know you, they fear you and they come up with their own language to describe you. But we're very strong. That's the key. It's the strength is our culture and who we are.
Almaz Negash is founder of the African Diaspora Network. The third annual African Diaspora Investment Symposium is this weekend at the Computer History Museum in Mountain View. All the information is at klw.org. Click Cross Currents. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hanna Baba. Contemporary classical composer Sahba Aminikia came to San Francisco as a refugee. Born and raised in Iran in the 80s, he left as a young man to study music in Russia and then got his bachelor's and master's of music at the San Francisco Conservatory of Music. The music he composes is deeply tied to his Iranian roots. He's written pieces inspired by traditional work songs of Persian carpet weavers or incorporating the voices of Iranian women who
singing has been stifled by religious restrictions. Aminikia came into KALW studios to talk about his music and where it comes from in this edition of Bay Area Beats.
My name is Sahba Aminikia, and I'm an Iranian-American composer based here in San Francisco. I was born and raised in Iran in the 1980s, and I moved here to the States in 2006. This piece is called Night and Fog, or Shab-o Meh in Farsi. I wrote this piece specifically depicting what happened to me in 2012. I was going back and forth between Iran and the United States. I went back to Iran in December, and it was at the ending reign of President Ahmadinejad. And basically, I was abducted and arrested in front of my parents' house, blindfolded, handcuffed, and pushed into a car. And three people with guns basically took me on a ride. A few months before, I had an interview with American TV, Persian-speaking American TV, and that was the reason that I was getting arrested. They noticed that I was doing that, and I was now in Iran. So they arrested me, took me on a five-hour ride, basically beat me up, and they asked me many questions about where I was coming from, where was supporting me, like financially, you know, was it an American spy agency or anything that has related to U.S. intelligence. And basically, I was taken to a desert outside of Iran near the shrine of Khomeini, who's the founder of the Inqilab, ironically. And they left me there in the middle of the desert. They put a gun in my mouth and asked me if I'm a Baha'i. I should say it three times and they can kill me. So the guy started pulling the trigger in my mouth, and there was no bullet in the gun, and they left me there half naked and with all my clothes off and all my documents taken and with pepper spray in my eyes and in my nose and mouth. I woke up and I had this amazing epiphanic moment. Basically, when I was seeing this blurry line of lights coming from Iran, you know, and it was so beautiful. I think it's one of those moments that you realize that you are the only one who have maybe that kind of experience, and at sometimes you realize that you have to take advantage of that moment and find some sort of beauty in that and meaning in that, otherwise you wouldn't be able to continue. They asked me to get back to Iran in 48 hours and come back, and I never come back to Iran. And I've been here since, and I've written three pieces about that incident, you know, so that is an exorcism piece in a way. When coming to this country, I realized that this is a new culture. I have to find my own roots here. But at the same time, I realized that many of the events that happen in my life, you know, when I want to actually express them in any way here, that it would be too weird and it would be very harsh and extreme for people. And it's sometimes hard for them to absorb that sort of situation. I mean, for us living in Iran, you know, during the 80s, I'm talking about it right now, and I'm, as just part of a history, I'm telling the stories that happened to me. But we have to realize that even those times, we were very happy people living in that city, because I think it's part of the human nature that you find your own ways of surviving, and those skills, like evolutionary skills, that you can basically rely on and survive the harshest situations. My first musical memories actually go back to the 80s when I was growing up in Iran. And right after the revolution, after the 1979 Islamic Revolution in Iran, music was entirely banned from the eyes of the public, you know, and that applies to radio, television, everywhere. After the music was actually, you know, started to get regulated, you know, under a specific ministry for culture, the only source of music on TV and radio was basically either the children programs or religious music, basically, and or revolutionary songs. You know, that was part of the political propaganda as well. Basically, the only window of hope for us, you know, for children, was to actually sit at 5 p.m. and watch this amazing TV show, you know, for an hour. was like a collection of different kind of stories, puppets, all sort of shows for children. That was the only part of our life, you know, that we could actually listen to music that was secular and wasn't, following any political agenda. And many composers and musicians those days, actually, they moved to the TV because it was state TV. You know, there were only two analog channels on TV. It created actually a generation of composers and artists during that era, which were obviously under pressure, you know, and it was a hard time to live, but they all basically expressed themselves inside of that tiny window of opportunity that they had, you know, in order to invest in the next generation. That's what they did, I guess. It's common in Iran, you know, to say that no matter how bad it is, you know, it might become worse. That's something that should be in the back of everyone's mind, no matter where you're living. And entering the States and realizing that certainly culturally, you know, we're very different, you know, coming from different backgrounds and different stories, but Iran and the United States, I think we're very close in many ways. I think the fact that we're experiencing the same human emotions, the same human processes that we were, for example, experiencing 4 years ago when Ahmadinejad was in power, you know, and he was a populist and he came out in power exactly the way that President Trump did. For me, it's an amazingly educating experience to see that the same loop, the same process, and the same flow exists in every single country.
That was composer Sahba Aminikia in a segment produced by KALW's Jen Chien. You can listen to a commissioned piece of his music this Saturday at the Conservatory of Music in San Francisco. All the details are at KALW.org. Click Cross Currents. Today's local music is by Oakland's psychedelic pop band Sugar Candy Mountain. They'll perform at the Rickshaw Stop in San Francisco Thursday night. Show starts at 8 o'clock. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.